Thank you very much, and thanks all for coming. Yeah, basically you already summarized everything I wanted to say, right? So a feedback model, basically, I want to, which is based on sync particles. That's what I'm going to present. But after that, if there's time, I also want to link that to turbulence, the density PDF, and how we get an estimate for the star formation rate. And then actually what we learned from this feedback then feeds back into the star formation rate. So let me start with a little motivation. So this is basically a feedback bomb. In a galaxy simulation, that's probably just one cell wide, but still, what happens there makes all the feedback. So these massive stars induce ionization fronts and winds, and basically this feedback is, as we all know, extremely important for galaxy formation and evolution. But I would want to go one step further and say that in this chain of feedback processes from small scales, there's also something that's happening on even smaller scales, which are these jets. So for example, here in this region, which you can't see, but when I zoom into this, then you see that there's a jet forming here from a protostar. So it has this beautiful bipolar shape and a bulk shock. And so
scale on your opening slide.
The scale, I don't actually know, but it's probably a few tens of parsecs. So a typical cloud size, say 20 parsecs or so. So my point is that these jets, they act on very small scales, but nevertheless, they may carve out, basically, cavities for the radiation to then escape, at least if it's a high-mass star, which can then act on the very large scale. So maybe this process is also important, and I would like to focus on the effect of these very small-scale protostellar outflows. Also, of course, these are not just happening for high-mass stars, but also for intermediate and low-mass stars. And in fact, the energy in the outflows, if you combine them all, they are comparable to the energy in like winds and supernovae. So there's a lot of energy in these effects. Okay, so basically what I'm trying to say is that these jets, because they're driven magnetically, so we have to include magnetic fields in this, but we'll get to that. Basically, the effect of these outflows is that a core which forms a star does not actually swallow up all the mass that's in the core, but instead some stuff is being spit out of the core in this outflow or jet. And what that produces is an effective core-to-star efficiency. So there's not the whole mass falls onto the star, but only maybe 50%, maybe only 30%. And this has been argued to possibly explain the shift between the dense core mass function and the stellar initial mass function, which is also about this efficiency. Whether that's true or not is subject of debate, but still, I mean, if we can find something like this, it seems to make sense, at least. So actually, in magnetic fields, there are two effects. They reduce fragmentation. And here's, for example, a simulation by Myers et al, where they have magnetic field and radiation, magnetic field, no radiation, and just hydro, so no magnetic field and radiation. And you see that the large-scale structures are actually determined by the magnetic field, but also there's small-scale fragmentation that you then get rid of by the radiation. So it's really the combined effect of magnetic fields and radiation that produce, basically, that determine the fragmentation. But we also know, as I said, that these magnetic fields, as they wind up the disk, drive a bipolar outflow and jet. And this is now also seen in SPH simulations here by Price et al. Okay, so when we do this ourselves, we basically just take a core that rotates. It's basically a gas block that rotates and collapses. And because it rotates, it collapses to form a disk. And the wind, or the jet in this case, is launched from the disk. So there's a disk here. And this is already what we get with our subgrid model. So this is with the subgrid model at low resolution. So you have to compare basically this with the one on the right. So that just launches the jet by winding up of the magnetic field. So So this has no subgrid model, and you can see that it's only like a bubble that is expanding. But as you increase the resolution, you see that you actually form a jet. And this actually goes on. So if I had an even higher resolution, then the jet would be, there would be more mass loading on the jet, it would be faster, more momentum, and so on. And so basically the idea is that at low resolution with the subgrid outflow model, we can reproduce these effects at extremely high that would only be seen at extremely high resolution.
So what's your magnetic field initially?
It's just a uniform magnetic field in this case. It's being twisted and it's like a spring.
And the needle moving, the jet seems to see.
Yeah, so this is, as I said, this is just one resolution higher. But if I went even higher, then there would be more mass, more momentum in the jet component. So this is a particular case, yes. So you see that here's more mass loading, simply because it would actually be more like this at higher resolution. So you can't take that as the converged solution for the problem. It just shows that there's a qualitative change when you increase the resolution.
Okay. And then also a qualitative change.
Yeah, so that's the next thing. So first we need sink particles. Why do we need sink particles? Well, basically, in the center of these disks, we form a sink. And if we didn't do that, we would just stall the code, because the density goes up super exponentially, actually. So and then the freefall time goes down, and the time steps go down, and you can't do anything. I mean, it's just ridiculous to form a star cluster. It would never work. You can only follow the first star that forms. So that's one thing. We want to sort of cut off the accretion, or cut off the collapse, the runaway collapse, in a controlled way. And we do this with sink particles. And there's a natural scale that needs to be resolved, which has been shown by Truloff et al. So the gene slums. And basically, he says we should resolve this with four grid cells. And if you turn that around, you can get a resolution criterion for the density. So whenever your local density exceeds that, you violate the Jeans condition, which means you should basically do something. Either heat up the gas, as some people do, or cut off the density and put it, for example, into a sink particle. And that's exactly what we do. But we have to be very careful when we do this. So for example, this is a grid, and here's a cell that exceeds this density threshold. So in principle, that would violate the Jeans condition. But if this stuff here is not actually self-gravitating, if it were just a shock that, for example, pushes the density above the resolution criterion, we would form a spurious sink. So we have to make sure that in this genes volume, in this case, and this is how we do it in our implementation, that in this volume, the gas is really collapsing and is bound. And we do this by introducing additional checks. So OK, it's clear. It must be on the highest level of AMR. But it must be converging from all sides. There must be a gravitational potential, a minimum in the gravitational potential. And it must be bound, taking all contributions of the energy into account, kinetic, turbulent, and thermal energy. And when you do this in a calculation where you basically, again, take a gas blob with some turbulence in it, so it gets some structure typical of a molecular clump or a small molecular cloud, and do this with all the checks on and without the checks, then you see that you form all these, at these high density peaks, you form all these spurious sink particles. And you basically overestimate the star formation rate and also the amount of mass that goes in to the stars. And even more importantly, the number of sinks is here about 10 times as much.
So I guess I'm most familiar with star formation applications, so maybe I'm missing something. But my understanding of the Truloff criterion was that, you know, when you exceed this criterion, there could be unresolved smaller fragmentation. Like you're unstable to fragmentation on a spatial scale that you can't resolve. So I guess it's not clear why, you know, you need, you know, I guess physically, my understanding would be that all that's required is that when your cell exceeds this density, you could be forming lots of these fully self-gravitating, dense, collapsing clumps inside of it. They wouldn't have the mass of the whole cell, the way I guess the sink particle assumes, but it doesn't seem like there needs to be a global criterion that the cell is globally self-gravitating for you to form lots of self-gravitating structure in it if you do it.
Actually, Truloff et al. it's actually the opposite. Yeah. So it's actually artificial fragmentation that you get when you don't resolve this. So it's not that you that you don't resolve the fragmentation on smaller scales. That might be possible also, but it's more that if you don't resolve the gene length sufficiently, you get artificial fragmentation. So it fragments even though it shouldn't. So it's actually the opposite.
But I think the real reason of the
kid
of the guy is that when you exceed this density, your numerical solution is dominated by computational. Whether it triggers artificial fragmentation or whether it triggers lack of fragmentation is a sensitive aspect of the global condition of your cloud and the details of your solver.
Yeah.
But to first order, what it tells you is, Ethereum tells you that beyond this density, you're basically looking at numerical garbage. Mm-hmm. And so it's not clear whether it's artificial fragmentation,
yeah,
which was the case for the Truder experiment, or when in galaxy formation, if I don't have enough resolution, I see no fragmentation at all.
Yeah.
Although my disk should fragment. Mm-hmm. Right. So that's.
Yeah. I guess this was. So I mean, you know, what it equates to basically is my gene's length becomes smaller than my cell size, right?
Then you're dominated by computational.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, my understanding, which I think is more relevant in the galactic disk case, is that the sense of the error you end up getting is that you force it to fragment not on the small scale that it should fragment, but on the, you get artificial fragmentation in the sense that the fragmentation scale moves up to the grid scale rather than some much smaller scale.
So maybe in fact this criterion may not be so relevant in the end of the day. It may just be that you have to, which is clear also, you also came up with a criterion that it actually collapses, that it's actually gravitational bound before you basically label it as star forming. I think that's the main point.
I mean, it's been shown that it's very highly relevant in many situations. If you get artificial, spurious fragmentation, if you don't
just
this part, you just get
I'm just saying that it is a separate issue. So it's resolving the gene length, but at the same time making sure that when something is collapsing, that you actually make sure that it is really, or check that it is collapsing before you heat it up, for example, or artificially put a sink particle there. But I agree, of course, it's important to resolve the gene length. Yeah. And I'll actually show more about resolving the gene length in just a few minutes.
And the gene length, if you look at gene theory, it's a uniform background that you perturb. That's how you get the gene length, right? It's not what we have here, it's a mess here.
So
obviously what you need is to have more, as you say, more checks. But the gene length is just an indication that you're probably dominated by computational.
But it's also, also for the gene length criterion to apply, you have to be dominated by the thermal support. If you're dominated by turbulent support, your thermal gene length is
relevant. That's also absolutely true. And also magnetic fields can be added in principle to the criterion, which is not the case here.
You also have a check on angular momentum, because it would also clamps that are
working. Rotary support.
No, I don't have that, but it's sort of, okay, if it's just stable and would like orbit around, then in principle you might want to accrete it, but basically the converging flow check would sort of avoid if stuff is again like spiraling outwards, it wouldn't kick in and you wouldn't form a sink in this case. So anyway, these checks seem to be important. So when we have these sinks, the good thing is we have an accretion rate, basically. So stuff is falling onto the sink and we accrete it. So we know what the rate is. And from theories, like Ralph Puttritz developed theories on that, also others, we know that these jets launch a mass that is proportional to the accretion rate with a fraction that is somewhere between 10 and 30%. So we can use the fact that we now know the accretion rate to sort of put mass back onto the grid with a given velocity. And the velocity that's also known should be the Keplerian velocity, very close to the protostar. And we use here 10 solar radii because that's a typical protostellar radius. And it's just the Keplerian speed because you have this lever arm that sort of spirals the stuff up and launches it. And in our model, we take this prescription. And we also have angular momentum transport, which is actually a feature that is not there in any of the previous implementations, for example, by Nakamura and Lee. They have a similar model. And also Stella Offner showed last week a similar model, which is in the Orion code, but they don't have that. Yeah, basically, this is the geometry. So you have the sink particle, and then you have an opening angle here, which is, of course, which you can define. But we know from the centrifugal acceleration mechanism that this should be about 30 degrees or so. And then we launch it along the rotation axis, which is also typical, because that's how a real jet is launched, because of the rotation. So the only free parameter, because these things are determined by either dedicated numerical simulations, so this fraction here, and this is 90%, so we eject 90% of the accreted angular moment, those things are actually determined by either theory or dedicated numerical simulations that resolve the physical process itself, and also by observations, in fact, that try to measure certain things. And so what remains here of these five parameters that go into the subgrid model is just the outflow radius. So how big do I have to make those cones in order to converge on things? And we find, which I'll show you in a second, that about 16 cells for the radius is good. Then we have about 1,000 cells in each of those cones, which is sufficient to sort of get roughly the right angular momentum transport, the right mass, velocities, and so on. So how does it look like? Yeah.
The outflow velocity, that's the outflow velocity at the star, right? Not the outflow velocity farther down.
That's right. So in fact, what you see further up is significantly lower in speed, significantly, factors of a few. Sorry? It depends on entrainment and things like that, so it's not that you can always tell what it is, I think. But it drops by about a factor of three or so.
I heard you just sink particle, say, compared to the inner part of the pedestrian.
How big?
Yeah.
So the sink particle radius is always given basically by half the gene's length. So it's at that density where you introduce the sinks. So the disk is much bigger than the sink. But it depends, of course, on like how far you go down in resolution, basically.
But it, fraction
it, it so that's exactly so what I'm doing here. So here the sink particle radius is here 20 AU, 10 AU, 5 AU. So this is a resolution study without the subgrid model. So I just want to make sure that everybody gets the point that this does not converge if you don't have a subgrid model. You get a jet basically here, and it would actually continue if you increase the resolution further. The jet would become even faster, and there would be more mass. So that's not converged. And now when we add the subgrid model that I just described, at that resolution, so the resolution is the same, and we just add, all I do is switch on the subgrid model, I basically get, again, this jet component, and I get also more mass and so on and so forth. So this is just a visual impression, of course. So let's look at the more detailed analysis. So we can define a region where we measure outflow mass, shown in this panel, outflow momentum, outflow angular momentum, and outflow speed. And again, without subgrid model, over like seven different resolutions or so, we find that it converges very, very slowly. So basically here, increasing resolution, you get further and further towards a converged solution. And it would actually only converge at level 17 or so, at which point you do resolve the protostar, almost resolve the protostar. And so with the subgrid model switched on at an intermediate resolution, we basically roughly try to match the right solution, basically, that you would get if it were entirely converged. So this for the momentum. The angular momentum doesn't work quite so well, because it's still difficult to inject the right amount of angular momentum in such a small zone, so you really need the resolution for that to get this right. And anyway, it's a grid code, so it's a bit more difficult to get this particular thing right. But also the speeds here, and as I said, the speed here goes to about 30 instead of 100. But it's measured like at 1,000 AU away from the actual protostar. So it slows down.
The always only from one single particle?
In this case, yes. So yeah, this is forced. Just a test simulation, so
is
as
it forced, or is it you just never go gravitationally?
Oh, yeah, okay. This kind of disk does not fragment, I guess, because it has the conditions for a protostellar disk early on. So it, I guess if you waited longer and if the resolution were higher, then of course it should fragment at some point and form planets, essentially, but that's not what we, what we can follow here.
Why does the outflow velocity seem to saturate? Like, I mean, what, because that's very close to the escape speed from a star forming cone.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, and so it's crucial to get that right, because that'll determine whether the material escapes.
So it actually should increase very slowly with the Keplerian speed, which it basically does. Oops, sorry. So it's sort of the way we launch the outflow, it goes up like this, but also the volume in which we measure this is finite, so we don't actually follow it to extremely far distances. I'm not sure that answers your question. I guess it doesn't.
Can you rephrase the question? Does the jet get outside of the region for the quantum? Does it cause material to escape?
Eventually, yes. I mean, yeah, so the clump is about this big. Well, it's actually zoomed in, so you get, I mean, the disk is super thin and it sort of breaks out of everything. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I would really show the escape speed from an inch radius to capital disk. So that finds your basic outflow velocity. You can show from any radius that the disk can launch it, get the right launching angle, you'll get one escape speed from that radius.
The protostar would escape speed from the matter to your interior. Yeah, but what I'm asking about is the escape speed from the star forming region.
It'll get, so they get the escape speed from the star at that radius if you want it. The disk is not the magical mass of the star. That's the scaling you can ask for.
Okay, so the model apparently reproduces the small-scale physics, basically, so the magnetic launching mechanism reasonably well, at least the effect on the large scales. This is like converged within 50 to 100%. So within a factor of two, we get it right, basically. Yeah?
So maybe you're going to show this, but this is very impressive for this study. Have you looked at how we change the initial conditions of the disk? Does that change this? And is there some allowance in the subgrid model for, say, you know, different disk masses or angular momentum?
I haven't, but others have actually tried that without a subgrid model, and they find that. So there's a list of people who did actually simulations on this without a subgrid model, and they find that jet properties are relatively insensitive, actually, to like the choice of the magnetic field strength and also the choice of the rotation of the core. So it's sort of almost self-regulated, in a sense, what you get. So it doesn't vary like dramatically. And also with protostellar radius, it doesn't vary dramatically, which is why we sort of went with a very simple model that does not take that into account. Well, one could, of course, take into account a dependence on the field and rotation and so on and so forth. But we try to make it as simple as possible for the first kind of application.
Can you clarify what you mean when you say without the subgrid model?
Without subgrid model, I just mean real physics, so MHD, basically. So you have a magnetic field that gets wound up, that gets compressed, and you have a magnetic pressure gradient that actually launches the jet. So it's the actual jet launching mechanism resolving that. With a sync particle still, yeah. But that's just to cut off the runaway collapse. It doesn't launch anything, so it just swallows mass instead of spitting anything out.
What sets the mass loading in those things? It's not obvious. You'd want to compare to that calculation as the right answer.
Sorry, the mass loading?
Yeah, it's not. So in the outflow, you're calibrating to what you take to be the right answer, which is
which is just a typical protostellar collapse, pretty typical protostellar core that collapses and forms a star.
And people believe the mass loading results for the outflow in that case. I guess I mean, normally the mass that actually makes it onto the outflow, I would have thought would be non-trivial to get right.
Well, again, from the theoretical models, and also from simulations that do resolve these processes properly, they find that about 30% of the mass accretion rate basically is the outflow rate. And what is entrained is, of course,
can be anything from much smaller to much bigger than that for the outflow rate.
The very simulation from the Japanese group.
Well, this is the list of basically people who have looked at these parameters, and they find that those are the basic parameters that you get in this problem.
For magnetically driven outflows, the mass output rate is not trivial to get correct. So Ralph, you'd say this third is the theoretical answer independent?
Where does this range of people who do the calculations run from a tenth to a third, but it doesn't seem to be more extreme than that. That's for quite a variety of initial conditions for the collapse. When you're set up for the disk. Basic theoretical models seem to kind of confirm that.
So this is outflow from the...
From the disk.
Yeah. From the disk itself.
From the disk.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's where the launch is.
So, for example, the most recent calculations are from Seyfried et al., where also Ralph is involved, that actually show these percent. Yeah.
I mean, when I was a kid, there was always a fight between Chu and others about whether the disk was launched or the jet was launched from the interaction of the atmosphere at the star, and that's where the thunderstorm. It sounds like it's a solved problem.
Yeah. So the X-wind theory, I think the X-wind theory predicts 30%, whereas the magnetocentrifugal theory predicts 10%, if I'm not mistaken.
Those are the ground truth. The 10 to 30% number comes from that.
Yeah.
I understand better.
But, yeah. It's... I don't worry so much about this for the model itself, because it sort of reproduces what I think it should on small scales, at least roughly. But yeah, of course, the details are much more involved.
So the reason I'm asking is that I would say, you know, in the black hole context, we worry a lot about mass loading onto jets, and there it's all governed by non-ideal effects.
Okay.
And
I see.
All the processes that are not included, perhaps, in these calculations.
Is that like from the centrifugal core, the stuff that's associated with black hole?
I think this is that, but it's also an issue if you have a Blanchard-Payne disk-driven wind, the mass loading onto the wind is very tricky to get to calculate a priori. That's why I was surprised. And I know this number is...
This almost certainly does not very easily transfer to other problems like black hole occlusion, I don't think. I mean, this is sort of calibrated for protostellar conditions. But in principle, the numerical technique itself could be used, of course, to launch also like an AGN or whatever. I don't know. Something you guys should tell me, I guess. So, it basically reproduces the physics, but it should also converge. So it should, a good subgrid model should also adjust to changes in the resolution, which we try to show here. So this is, again, a comparison with a model that has no subgrid, with a simulation that has no subgrid model. And those are all simulations with subgrid model, where we basically varied the resolution and also the number of cells in the outflow radius. And as I said, so this black line is basically the standard model. It does indeed converge for the speed. So from green to red to black to, what is that, pink or, no. It sort of converges. So it would actually, probably this is extremely close to the converged value. So, but the difference here is only 25%. So we thought, okay, we try to get away with just using 16 cells because it gets more, implicate the whole SGS launching region, basically, if they are at the border of a processor and so on and so forth. So basically, this gives us a subgrid model that is more or less converged to within a factor of two or so of the real solution. And so now that we have that, we can put that into a calculation of star cluster formation. And this shows a comparison again where we switch the SGS off, and here's this with the SGS on, and this is a parsec, so it's a typical star forming region inside a molecular cloud. Of course, the boundary conditions are artificial and wrong, but we put in some turbulence. It's a typical kind of thing that people do when they study star formation. They just put some turbulence in and a clump that basically collapses, and let's see how that goes. So set the turbulence basically produced, and where the density is high enough, you form these stars. And then here you see that you blow out these jets, whereas everything just falls towards the center in the case without the outflows. And so importantly, we form more objects actually here. This is because the accretion streams that are relatively coherent in this case, they break up, or they are broken up by the outflows into multiple accretion streams that fall onto separate objects, which means you form more things. You also perturb basically the whole interior so that you get more fragmentation. And also, of course, you eventually you don't wind up as much mass in the sinks as without. So more quantitatively speaking, comparing here the mass fraction, or how much goes into sinks as a function of time for these two cases, no outflow dashed and with outflow solid, you eventually end up getting everything into the sinks, whereas with the model, or basically a quarter or so of the core is being like launched away, and can basically reach distances of more than a parsec. And so the star formation rate also is reduced by about a factor of two. It's not a big effect, but it's a noticeable effect.
How do you decide when to stop the simulation? Because
some
differences might change as you continue further in the simulation. How do we know that they would keep looking so different even at three, four?
I mean, at this point, we are already sort of in a relatively unrealistic regime, because other effects like radiation that are not included in this should also kick in. But it's important, I think, to realize that the jets are actually the first feedback process to kick in before any of the others kick in. So I wouldn't believe that necessarily the very late evolution.
So for the core cluster simulation, coming back to the first question I asked, what I was really more trying to get at as well is, because your sink prescription, right, you, when a cell's collapsing, that whole thing collapses to one particle, do you find convergence in the sense of running this cluster in the number of sinks, or as you refine, does the fragmentation move to smaller, like you just end up with more of a smaller sink particle?
You mean in this one?
Yeah.
Basically, yeah.
Okay,
so yeah, that's an important point. So the resolution here is actually insufficient to, and also the physics. As I said, there's no radiation feedback, and we know that it's important to get the fragmentation right, is not included, and the resolution is insufficient to actually follow it down to the opacity limit where fragmentation basically stops. But, I mean, those calculations are just too expensive, basically, to follow them to such high density. So in principle, if we had higher density, we would get actually more sink particles. But very importantly, the ratio between the two cases stays the same, which I actually wanted to show you next. So there is a resolution study. And what I'm showing here is the average mass of sink particles in the runs with outflow divided by the average mass of sinks in runs without the outflow model. And this actually goes down, as you can see, to one third. So, and it's relatively independent of resolution or also the turbulent seed. Of course, you can use a different turbulent realization that makes just a slightly different cloud. So but the actual numbers are not converged.
One third is the number you put in? What did you
No, that's what comes out of the simulation.
So what do you put in for the fraction, the mass loading again?
It's this standard value of 0.3. So 0.3 of the accretion, of the accreted mass is being launched in the outflow. Yeah.
What is the safe state for your cluster?
So the typical velocities, again, are of order 20 kilometers per second or 30 kilometers per second or so. No, not at all. It's actually much smaller. So the turbulent motion is of the order of 4 or 5 kilometers per second. Actually lower than that.
Could you check the
3 kilometers per second.
Could you check the efficiency of star formation as a function of, I would have thought it's a function of the ratio of the jet velocity to the escape speed of the cloud.
Sorry, say it again. What is the function of that?
If you have a cloud with an escape speed that's higher than the jet velocity, then I would have thought you'd get 100% star formation.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have, basically, you put a jet that is 30 kilometers a second speed inside a cluster that has an escape speed of 2 kilometers a second, you might get a very, very low star formation.
Yes, yes.
So
okay.
I would have thought there would be a dependence.
There almost certainly is a dependence, but I haven't looked at the actual velocities. I'm just measuring basically what I get when I compare the whole mass that falls onto 6 as a function of time.
I'm guessing that curve depends specifically on escape speed of the cloud.
Of course. I mean, if I made the cloud much denser, then it would not be able to escape. That's what you're basically saying, which is true. So, so I basically just took a typical. So this kind of setup is just a very typical molecular clump, but of course there's a dispersion to that. So, denser clumps, for example, would certainly show less an effect of the outflow, whereas more diffuse gas is like penetrated very easily.
Higher mass clusters would have protoclusters. Often we're interested in the feedback from the most massive protoclusters. They have high escape speeds, maybe higher than the velocities that your jets have.
Possibly, but then the jets might also be much stronger.
Yeah, for really massive star clusters.
That's what I'm
saying. PMCs, I think they're not.
But
I think even in this case, what you're finding is that they're not unbinding that much mass from the from the cloud or the cluster. Like they're not reducing the interval amount of mass that turns into stars. The much more dramatic effect is reducing the mass of the stars.
I think that's the more important effect, definitely, that you basically get something that might remind you of this, although it's, of course, not clear that there's a one-to-one mapping, but it is sort of the average mass is really reduced, average star mass is reduced by a factor of 3, so that's an important effect on the IMF that is definitely noticeable.
Yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, they all go down, though, to a third. You think they might go up again in these other cases? Yeah, true. The 256 is actually here, yeah. Okay, yeah. The dotted.
Is there any way to keep that one going?
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah. I just stopped them, basically, because... Yeah, true. Okay, so those are basically the main results of this outflow story. Although,
this is like about the next slide, but also about some other, your paper on deformation efficiency, deformation model. So if you look at your deformation efficiency for free fall time, you see numbers like 30% and so on. So how do you?
So actually, this actually fits almost perfectly to the star formation rate model that I wanted to explain in a few minutes, yes.
Okay. I just wondered how it compares to...
Given the input parameters, Mach number, the way the turbulence is driven, and also the magnetic field strength, and the virial parameter. So given those parameters that I think determine primarily the star formation rate, that actually fits perfectly. But that's all in the paper.
So how does this compare to observations where observers tell us that the clumps, like Evans, they have efficiency per freefall time of a few percent?
Well, I mean, we have. I think we have to still distinguish the different scales here. I mean, this is like a very dense part of a GMC. And there, of course, the star formation rate can be much higher than in the whole GMC. So I think the whole GMC only has a few percent per freefall time. Yes.
I'm talking about the measurements in the clumps within the GMC, the very dense clumps, densities where they argue that star formation rate is proportional to the mass of gas in those solutions. And because of the proportionality, the size of the derived 5%.
Yeah. Yes. So basically what you're saying is exactly what I'm saying too, is that this kind of setup is wrong. It's unrealistic. It doesn't, I mean, this isolated boundaries, right? For example, so this is in reality, of course, this whole thing is embedded in a molecular cloud. And there are shear effects and tidal effects that are just, that can't be taken into account. I think the star formation rate is probably overestimated. But what I'm saying is, given the parameters of these of this dense clump, it fit, the model can actually predict almost exactly the correct star formation rate for freefall time. But the those parameters are probably not realistic. I agree.
One way to mitigate the
effect, it's too unstable, basically.
Is to use a fundamental cloud.
Yeah.
So then you're not going to get a 3D collapse. You're going to get a fundamental collapse, and you mitigate this.
That's what I'm running at the moment, but I won't be able to show that yet. So actually, of course, the goal is also to indeed resolve that properly, to get the mass right in the thing, so to actually resolve the fragmentation scale, which I haven't here, but that's the next step. So the thing I wanted to show you was also genes resolution study, because we talked about this and it seemed to be interesting. So the same setup, we have again this core that is rotating and making a disk. And so this is a genes resolution study. Genes resolution of 2 cells per genes length, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64. And yeah, you basically see that you get something that TrueLove predicts. So there's artificial fragmentation. In reality, there are, you can't actually see it, I guess. No. So there are actually 4 sync particles in this. So it does fragment artificially. But if you go to 4 cells, OK, that goes away. But when you look at the structure, it's not, I mean, it's not resolved with 4 cells.
And capital J is for each level of refinement, you resolve
for each level
local
of refinement
gene length by at least capital J less cells.
Correct.
So it doesn't mean you're resolving a gene's mass.
No. It's based on gene's length, yeah. And so you get this basically this strange flaring that goes away as you when you go to 30 cells or more. More quantitatively, again, we can look at the outflow mass, momentum, angular momentum, and speeds. So this is basically converged with different genes resolutions, but all the other stuff is not really converged with, say, 8 cells, which is often used. So really, again, you need at least 30 grid cells. So it's about 42, but maybe a bit less, but depending on the problem, of course, also. But it also seems that, for example, for getting the dynamo amplification on the gene scale right, which we looked at in this paper, and also the turbulent energy on the gene scale, you always need 30 grid cells per gene length or more, which is really an expensive thing to do. So people use usually 8 cells, maybe. But it, of course, goes like cube. So you need 4 cubed as much compute power, which is devastating. But I'm running everything now with 30 grid cells per gene length. So I can't go to as high resolution, but at least I can resolve the gene lengths properly. And all these effects should be roughly converged. So finally, I don't have time really to talk about this much, maybe 5 minutes on this topic, which is turbulence and predicting the star formation rate. So here's a basic problem. For example, two clouds that have very different star formation rates, but they have a similar mass and similar column density, but their star formation rate is more than an order of magnitude different. Or another way of looking is the Kennicott-Schmidt relation, which has a huge scatter. So somehow, I mean, we can't just take sigma gas and then we know what the star formation rate is. There's like scatter by more than two orders of magnitude. And I would argue that turbulence can explain some of the scatter. I mean, there are obviously also observational problems and all kinds of problems, but maybe there's also physical scatter that is introduced by the turbulence. So I wanted to talk a little bit about turbulence, Kolmogorov turbulence, but we don't have Kolmogorov turbulence. No, it's supersonic. So the spectrum actually goes more like k to the minus 2, which we see in the ISM and or in molecular clouds. And we do see it also in numerical simulations. For example, Kritzog et al. Or myself have shown that the slope here is really, if you have supersonic turbulence, it's much steeper than the 5/3 of the Kolmogorov turbulence.
So those are isothermal?
All isothermal, yes. If you go now and you basically have to revise this picture. So you have a supersonic cascade and then a subsonic cascade because, of course, the energy drops with scale. And so there must be some kind of scale which is called sonic scale. And we think that this is where all the important action goes on in terms of fragmentation, where you form the cores. And so you can imagine that this may be a molecular cloud, and then you have your core at 0.1 parsec. And we'll see that the sonic scale is an input for a theory of star formation based on turbulence. There might also be another scale that is actually something that Oscar and Alessandro Romeo work on. And so the question is, what drives turbulence? And again, Carina, so there are winds, outflows, supernova explosions, but also galactic scale things might do some damage, like spiral shock or whatever. But it's all basically compressing the gas, or most of these drivers compress the gas, which motivates theoretical or very idealized simulations where we put everything in a periodic box and just drive the turbulence artificially, which is totally unrealistic, but we have full control over how we drive the turbulence. So we can actually change this and drive it as many people have done before with these solenoidal modes where they mix the gas and the other extreme that we basically introduced, or actually others have done that before, but they didn't make such a big point out of it. But we think that the actual drivers of turbulence are more like this. So when we do this and put this in an extremely high resolution simulation with 4,000 cubed grid cells, then we get these kind of structures. So this is just driven to a typical Mach number of, in this case, 15 or so of a relatively big GMC. Of course, it's periodic boundaries again. It's not realistic driving, but it's just to systematically analyze the effect of such different driving modes. And you see that we get a fractal dimension here of, I'm just using new technology here, of almost 3. So it's very volume filling, whereas this one is more like sheets. And in fact, observations do seem to favor this. Putting everything into a histogram and making a density PDF, we have seen that the compressive driving had much stronger enhancements of density and rarefaction. So the whole PDF is wider. So the solenoidal forcing gives this. And basically, we can understand what the standard deviation of these PDFs are. They depend on the Mach number, and in addition on that. Of course, more compression gives you a wider PDF, but also more compression, because the driving is different, also gives you a wider PDF. And in fact, also Phil has worked on a better model to actually fit these kind of PDFs.
You have no self-driving.
No, but I'm getting to that really fast. So eventually, the standard deviation versus Mach number relation we can test with numerical simulation. That seems to fit. Here's the one for compressive driving. Here's the one for solenoidal driving. And the clouds that we've looked at so far seem to suggest that B is somewhere in between. OK, I mean, there must be more observations to actually see how that really is. And I just want to point out that Jouni Kainulainen recently published a paper in Science like 2 weeks ago that also deals with the density PDF and how we can reconstruct the star formation rate from that. So eventually, how do we get from the PDF to the star formation rate? And so all these models here that are kind of successful depend on integrating the PDF above a given density threshold. We will have to define the density threshold, but the point is that we integrate this to get the dense gas mass fraction, so the fraction of the gas that can form stars. And to make a star formation rate, we have to get a mass and a time, divide by a time. And a typical time is the freefall time, and this would be the mass here. So integrated over everything above that critical density. And by the way, this is the local core to star efficiency. So that's something that we try to determine from the outflow, which is about, it's about 0.3 to 0.5 or so. Because this is really, this is of course what you would get without small scale feedback. And this basically tries to correct for the small scale feedback. Also worth pointing out is the fact that this is a multi-freefall model. So this is really inside the integral. We have to take into account that the freefall time depends on density. So denser structures collapse faster and have a higher star formation rate.
What's the density distribution log normal in your outflow
model? The PDF. Yeah. I haven't looked at this. This is actually the next step. I must look at this. So it's exactly. Stella has looked at this, I think, in hers. And I think it roughly was. But of course, you also have collapse, so you do develop a tail in the PDF, and there's all kinds of complications that might come into the business. But for simplicity, we just assume that we have a log normal PDF in order to make a prediction, which is not actually so bad, because before you form stars, you might assume that the PDF is indeed log normal, just from turbulence. And then when you form stars, it develops the tail, which is maybe just a byproduct of the collapse, but does not really determine the rate. But it could make a difference at late times, definitely. So putting everything in, simple math, you get a star formation rate that has basically this epsilon, so the cause of star efficiency parameter, and two other parameters, which is the width of the PDF, which we already have, and the critical density. And the critical density we simply get from comparing the thermal energy, basically, with the turbulent energy and the gravitational energy. It's basically just from comparing the sonic scale, so where we form the cores at about 0.1 parsec, and the genes length. And if they are equal, then we get a condition for the critical density, which depends on the virial parameter and the Mach number. And so the virial parameter is just the ratio of kinetic to gravitational energy, basically, in this formulation. And then there's, of course, because this depends on that, so we have basically a thing that depends on three parameters. So how does this look? Does this make any sense? Yes, of course. So as we, so I've just plotted that here for this parameter fixed. And so when we increase the virial parameter, then the cloud eventually is unbound. So it cannot form any more stars. So this must exponentially drop with increasing virial parameter, which it basically does. And as we increase the Mach number, the star formation rate should go up, simply because we compress more gas at very high densities, which can then collapse at a much faster rate. So in principle, qualitatively, it should make sense. And numerical simulations by Padoan et al. Actually show that the star formation rate does depend on virial parameter. So that's basically virial parameter in the way that is predicted by the model. So we can now also look at the dependence on the way the turbulence is driven. And indeed, if we make it more compressive, then we get a higher star formation rate. And now testing that in numerical simulations where we have control over these parameters. So this is the case with solenoidal driving, where B is a third, and this is with compressive driving. We get, so in this case, it's a periodic box again with gravity this time. We get very quick very quickly we get basically 20% of the cloud into stars. Again, this without feedback. Yeah? Here it takes much longer, actually, to wind up 20% in stars. So it makes a big difference how the turbulence is driven. Everything else is the same. Mach number, virial parameter, everything is the same, except for the driving. So quantitatively, this is really more than an order of magnitude slower in terms of star formation. And compares reasonably well with the theoretical prediction for the given parameters, Mach 10 and virial parameter B. In this case, the simulation was without magnetic field. We can also add magnetic fields by replacing the thermal pressure with the sum of thermal and magnetic pressure, which means we just have to replace the Mach number by something that's Mach number squared times beta over beta plus 1. And making the same kind of test without and with magnetic field for otherwise identical parameters, we find a reduction of the star formation rate by a factor of 2 with magnetic fields. The theory predicts something that is quite comparable to that. I mean, here's sort of some disagreement, I guess, but given that the model is so simple and, for example, does not take into account that the density PDF is not log normal and so on and so forth, it's actually not so bad. And in fact, when we do this for many, many different clouds with many, many different parameters, so different cloud masses are basically covering all the Milky Way type clouds from 300 to 4 times 10 to the 6 solar masses, basically just boxes with those different masses, different driving, and Mach numbers ranging in also the realistic regime and different magnetic field strengths. We get a plot where we have the theoretical prediction of the star formation rate versus the star formation rate from the simulations. And here's the one-to-one line. And all these different models basically, so the worst disagreement is a factor of 3, which are those. But for example, this is a low resolution, this is a higher resolution simulation. And also here, this is a low resolution, higher. So this 256, 512, 1024 cubed simulation. They seem to at least converge to this one-to-one relation, depending on the flavor of the theoretical model, which I don't have time to go into.
So these very low star formation per people time, these are unbound clouds?
Those ones, yeah. Well, not unbound, I guess. The virial parameter here is really off-order unity in all these clouds, actually. So all I'm varying is this. And the cloud mass, the cloud mass basically, when I increase the cloud mass, I also increase the Mach number according to the Larsen relations. So that, in fact, the virial parameter is almost unity in all of those clouds. So I did not vary that. But this is something that Padua and Nordlund have done. And they show that the model also reasonably well.
But the low freefall ones at fixed virial parameter do tend to be, the low star formation ones do tend to be the low Mach number clouds, right? Because there's slow fragmentation.
But I think it's not as easy as just looking at the Mach number, because it depends on more things. So if the Mach number is small, yes, you don't have much compression. But you also kind of, it depends on the virial parameter.
Yeah, I mean, I fixed virial parameter, more of my support's coming slowly, and I fragment much more slowly.
Oh, yeah, exactly. So, yeah. So as the Mach number goes down, star formation rate goes down. That's a theoretical prediction of that.
So, I missed this already, but when do you stop those simulations?
When 20% of the mass is in stars. Simply because then I assume that feedback would have altered the situation completely, and the simulations are not reliable anymore. Also, the PDF then, of course, changes to develop a power law tail.
You fix all the simulation at 20%?
Yeah, I just stopped them. I just stopped them. Eventually, they would, of course, go to 100% clump. But they do it at a much slower rate, though, than the isolated clump.
I'll just add the models which I'm comparing here, they're not intended to be equilibrium models for a steady state star formation rate. They're
they're instantaneous models, and you know, you have fully developed turbulence with these properties here.
Exactly.
The rate.
Extremely simplified models that just try to test the theoretical prediction. And
really like them on my field and use a beta rather than usually use a mass per unit kind of flux and mass ratio, which is
okay.
Gravity to magnetic energy.
Mm-hmm.
If you use that measure, and there's that issue if you add one for that number, then you suppress all fragmentation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You see that in the way you set this up.
I haven't written this in terms of the mass to flux ratio, so I don't actually know what the mass to flux ratio are. But they are almost certainly above unity, so they are
right.
Still super critical in this nomenclature.
So they're all the same in that sense.
Yeah. Well, I have actually studied a couple of magnetic field strengths from 0 to 1 to 3 to 10 microgauss, which gives you a range of. But it's all still super alphanic. I think that's what your point is. In fact, the model breaks down for subalphanic turbulence simply because this can't be written anymore as pressure, because you also have tension, which is then not taken into account by the model. So it only works for super alphanic turbulence.
The field is a constant DZ to start with, or?
Yeah, constant. But as you can see from the movies, it gets totally tangled, and essentially, when there are dense cores, then also the dynamo starts to amplify the field locally, which is kind of fun. So you see that you locally in these very dense regions, you can get very high field strengths, but it's all very intermittent, so it's a highly disordered field, I would say, in this case. No, the sink particles don't swallow anything. So that would break diff B. We had longish discussions about this, whether we should actually swallow or accrete magnetic flux. But I don't think it's a good idea, because you still keep the field. It's different in SPH, where you lose particles when you accrete them. You also lose the stencils or the resolution elements to keep the magnetic field there. But in a grid code, you still have the grid cells that can keep the magnetic. You can still describe the magnetic field there. It's not lost. So there's no need to accrete magnetic flux. Yeah, I think I'm totally out of time, and I should apologize for that and just show you one last thing, which is how does this all compare with observations? In this typical Kennicott-Schmidt frame, we can, of course, now take line of sights to each of the sink particles and measure what is the gas column density there, and also what is the star formation rate column density there. And when we do that, we get a plot like this. We do this for two different star formation efficiencies, 1 and 10%, which is a typical range of star formation efficiencies. So again, the simulation would actually go on and go to 100%. But of course, it makes sense that for the blue, which is 1%, and the red, which is 10%, you find exactly this behavior, because you take out more mass and you get a higher star formation rate, because there's more mass in sinks.
So what is what here? It's a simulation with observation, but what are the contours and what are the points?
So the contours just show, in this case, 50% of the red points in the red contour and 50% of the blue points around the peak in all the simulations, yeah.
So I think there's no observations on that one.
And so this contour just shows 99% of the scatter in.
It's at a particular time, so you're saying that the time goes on, this will move towards.
Exactly, yeah. And so I do this just so that it's easier to see where actually the simulation data are. Because the scatter is just easier to see the peak when you draw a contour. That's
right. Yeah.
And so I can put these Heidemann et al. Milky Way clouds into the plot. So there's torus and clouds. And so they actually are sort of consistent, but the simulations overpredict the star formation rate slightly. And this is actually no surprise, because there's no feedback in the simulation. So again, we need feedback, and we can, even though we have not included feedback, we can still adjust that parameter in the theory and adjust the simulation data accordingly. And when we do that, we get from 1, so from an efficiency of 1 without feedback to the value that we would get with, say, outflow feedback, which I showed you reduces the sufformation rate by a factor of 2. So epsilon should be about 0.5, maybe 0.3. And it is actually goes down, and the agreement is best in this case for 0.5. So I fitted the simulations by varying epsilon to the observations in this case, and I get with just one free parameter, and I get epsilon is 0.5. Which seems to be consistent with the outflow.
So what does it mean, sufformation efficiency of 1%? It's just that when you, it's per free flow time?
Ah, so 1% of the gas. 1% of the gas has collapsed.
Time goes on, it kind of goes up, and then
yep,
you're
exactly
showing what happens at when 1% is.
Exactly, yeah. So I just, it's just a time slice, basically, at a star formation efficiency of 1% for the blue and 10% for the red.
So is your interpretation of data, so data, I mean, they're different clouds, right? And so they all lie in this plane. Right?
Yes.
So in the data, is your interpretation that we're seeing clouds more or less in the same stage, which are just about to be disrupted by feedback? Or so data shows roughly 1%, right?
Yeah, exactly. So Evans actually argues that the star formation efficiencies are between 3 and 6 of the typical GMCs. This is really star formation efficiency, not star formation rate per free. A different thing. Kind of.
I'm still confused. So different points in the data, different GMCs, right?
Yeah, I think that's also not, I think some of these are probably in the same GMC, yeah. So these are actually pointings towards YSOs, for example, class 1 YSOs, those are flat spectrum YSOs.
I mean, these are really dense regions even within GMC.
Yeah. So
all, I mean, but you know, in the model, there is a time sequence that as time goes on, you know, you move.
That's right.
Whereas in observations, they point in a particular way. So
but I mean, how can you,
but
how can you observe a time sequence in the observation?
Well,
it's impossible.
If you look at different GMCs, supposedly they're at different times, right?
Yeah,
it
but
be all
true. They also have other parameters that vary. I mean, you can never really test the time evolution of a GMC.
Like
I agree. You have
many different
GMCs at different evolutionary stages. Yes, but they also have different parameters. Maybe.
In the, to the right, in the upper
yeah
corner, right? Upper left corner.
Here.
No, just very high evolution.
Here.
Just the upper left corner is empty, right?
You mean
100%.
There are no clouds there.
Yeah, right.
So you think that feedback stops the clouds from meeting there?
Yeah, I think so.
Makes sense.
But that maybe it's a stupid thing, but then I'm confused based on what you just said. You know, it's epsilon, because if you let the simulation go on, then everything will move up.
Yeah.
Right? So the epsilon is just working for the time that you actually stop the simulation.
Correct.
You will need a lower epsilon if you actually run it longer. Am I right? To get the data.
We have to artificially stop the simulation, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is like saying you would need a lower epsilon in reality, 10.5.
But given the star formation efficiencies that are observed by, for example, Neil Evans, of that order, so when I take my, when I look at my simulations for those typical star formation efficiencies, then this is what I get. But of course, if I kept the simulation, and then the epsilon would be 0.5 to match the observations. Which doesn't mean that if I continued, then it would still go up further, yeah.
And you reach 10% in think particle mass in like, you know, a fraction of the free flow time.
Oh yeah, depending on yeah, so basically determined by the particular parameter, Mach number, virial parameter B, and magnetic field.
I agree with that. I think you are seeing in your data a bit of a time sequence. Your HCM stuff, very dense clumps, very high column density over that side. And then your torus is way down here, which is a very evolved, you know,
The class ones are also down in the bottom left little column. So I do think you are mixing the time sequence.
I'm not so sure, but you can really read a time sequence in the observational data here.
I mean, you must know how this depends on your parameter. So what seems about this parameter is the would say the only low Mach numbers and more solar run versus compressive mixing as well. So you could also say the out specific parameters, right?
In principle, yes, we should, we can actually take a specific model and then try to match a particular cloud observation. That's right. Yeah, I haven't done that. That would be very cool if I could do that. But for that, I would need to know what is the Mach number of the cloud, for example. And so I'm trying to get observers basically to measure these parameters. So this corresponds to virial parameters, corresponds to the driving, the sonic Mach. But we actually don't really have those numbers, unfortunately, for the cloud. So
on that note, do you have a sense, simpler but still interesting question, how much of this scatter in the simulation points is coming from variation in the level versus, say, stochastic variation from time or
Yeah, I can't actually answer that directly. Well, if I remembered, so there are actually three models with the same parameters but different seeds of the turbulence. They are somewhere in here, but I don't know which ones they are. So in principle, from that we could look at how the
projections.
Actually. Okay, yeah, plus that, yes. I don't have that particular one, unfortunately. So, for example, here, so this shows the star formation efficiency as a function of time. And again, yes, it all goes up, so it eventually goes to 100%. But this shows the variation, at least with different turbulent seeds for a given set of parameters. So, yeah, you do have quite some variation there. But also, of course, different lines of sight, which I actually averaged in this plot. So I took three lines of sight, X, Y, Z. And I did not average them. I put all the points in this scatter plot. One could do a direct comparison, model by model, with also cloud by cloud, which would require, though, to know what are the parameters. And I'm desperately trying to get like Nicola Schneider, Joni Kainulainen, and Chris Brandt to actually measure these kind of things in real clouds so that we can make a really direct comparison of a given cloud with the model, for example, with a theoretical model. And so if you are now all tired and bored, then we can stop. But thank you.
So your models are like not quite GMC, they're somewhat smaller, right? A few parsec scale. So what my question is, it would be great to take this type of model and implement it in the arc formation simulation. But what is in your opinion is correct or optimal Kendall scale? The cells, what is the size of the cell?
Yeah. I think what you need is just to resolve the largest scales of a GMC, that would already be very good, because then you can estimate the Mach number properly. Because the Mach number is really determined by the largest scales. Also the beta parameter and also the virial parameter, those are all large-scale properties of the GMCs. And so if you could resolve a GMC, say, with 30 cells or so, or 42, I don't know, then you could measure those things and actually put that into your simulation, and put that into the theoretical model for the star formation rate, and then get a better estimate of what that should be for the given cloud.
Like a pocket cell, right?
For GMC, it unfortunately, yeah, few parsec should be enough, I think. A few, and I think you are getting there. I mean, very soon. yeah, come on, I think so.
You really need the first part of your talk. Kind of going by Jim's idea of just using the bare minimum for the subgrid feedback model.
Yeah.
You need then, like, once you prescribe your upload,
right,
you don't really need a magnetic field.
I don't need it. So, for example, Stella Ofner was showing models without magnetic field. But, I mean, the magnetic field does change the large-scale structure of the core, and so
fragmentation of the clouds and the
it, exactly, which I showed you. So, in principle, the model works, of course, without magnetic fields because it does not depend on that. But it, I think it just does not make much sense to include a subgrid model that is supposed to make protostellar jets that are in fact driven by magnetic fields and not have magnetic fields in the simulation.
Well, the point is it doesn't need a magnetic field in your basic.
I agree. Yeah.
That's the beauty of the theory. Really what matters there is the depth of gravitational potential realm. That's how the magnetic mechanism is tapping into that. And so you need it in your subgrid. That's just this interesting one example. Faced with all the feedback mechanisms, the time constraints that some money would come, whether you felt that you could just get away with this model of jets.
You mean without having magnetic fields?
Yeah.
I don't think you can. Because, as I said, the properties of the cores change with the magnetic field. So I mean, and in addition to that, it's really not much more expensive to run those calculations in magnetic field. So I think by now we should run these things. At least the small-scale simulations, I think, should all be run with magnetic fields. Because it just doesn't make sense not to have magnetic fields. Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, that's a different regime. I agree. But as we discussed this morning, I mean, they might be important also for cosmic rays. And so of course, yeah.
Coupling mechanism.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was also a point that Elliot was putting forward, which is actually that you need the magnetic field to also then feel the power of the, or distribute the power of the jet to make all the scales in the core feel actually this small scale needle that is sort of going through. But by coupling it to a larger scale magnetic field, which maybe if you don't have that, then you don't get really the feedback effect that we see. So those simulations I showed you were all done with magnetic fields, because again, I don't think it makes sense to run those without.
So you haven't mentioned a lot of the details of the STS scheme. Can you give us a brief update on that, and especially when it comes to NG?
You
presented it as being obvious for everybody, but
I basically tried to explain the model just with this one slide.
Maybe I'm confused, but the meaning of SGS is
subgrid scale.
Yeah, but that's the model we got to the.
Yeah. No, it has nothing to do with a turbulent subgrid model. It's really a subgrid model for outflows.
Is GMC subgrid scale?
Yeah.
Is it subgrid scale turbulent or subgrid scale synchronic?
No, it has nothing to do with a turbulent subgrid scale model. No, it's a subgrid scale model for launching protostellar jets. Ah, it's a subgrid. Yeah, it's a subgrid scale model. It's just for different things.
Okay.
Okay, so it's not this additional variable with the turbulence?
No.
Because VS is a standard nomenclature in fluid dynamics literature.
Yeah.
So we call them subgrid, but they call them subgrid scale. FGS.
Yeah, okay.
But whatever model you implement on subgrid scale.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that, but yeah, it's probably true. The turbulence
no,
people call it subgrid scale.
On SGS turbulence, they call it SGS, but it's SGS turbulence, right? So,
yeah.
But it would be SGS for something else, right? Subgrid scale.
The same thing. Yeah.
Okay. So then my question is
yeah. So the only thing that I skipped was basically applying the model to extragalactic scales, which is maybe questionable. But since Avishai Dekel is not here, okay. So you all know that there's the star formation rate, the KS relation. But then Krumholtz, Degen, McKee 2 years ago came up with this idea of plotting everything divided by threefold time. Okay, you get a tighter correlation, and a little bit at least. And so what I did now, because there's still a lot of scatter, so there might be variations in the turbulence being able to explain this, was to add actually much more data to this relation, much more, many more observations. And they all do seem to agree with this more or less universal thing, but there's still a lot of scatter. And so I put the simulations I showed you, I processed them the way that they should actually represent those Milky Way clouds. I mean, I do basically exactly what an observer would do if they observed the clouds. And so I find that the simulation data lie on this relation. But with different Mach numbers, there's a systematic change. So I can also plot then the theoretical model on top of that with some different flavors. And basically, my suggestion is that some of the scatter may be related to variations in the turbulence. That was just the last point that I made, which is all published last year. That's true or not? It's very hard to test because, again, it's very hard to measure Mach number, for example. And there starts the problem. If I knew the Mach number of these objects, yeah, then we could do a proper comparison. And so, yeah, thanks for your attention. Interesting.